Father, when you created this plan by which you would take a single man, Abraham, and through him create things that eventually would bring the entire universe under your son's authority. You created the biggest plan of all. And there was so much detail and so much we've yet to discover. I ask today for us that your son would be our teacher and that you would, for all of us, open our eyes at least a little to catch a glimpse of how big and how incredible your will really is and how much work you have put in revealing it. In Jesus' name, amen. We're in Leviticus 23. We are dealing with the feasts of Israel. And I will start by giving you some background about the Hebrew calendar. Okay? We may not actually get to read Leviticus 23 because we have so many details that it'll take care of itself. The Hebrew calendar has always been one based on the month, where the moon is. And yes, the word month comes from the word moon. So does the Arab calendar. They got their calendars both from the region, from the Semites, from Babylon, which also in those days had it. So there'll be similarities between the Hebrew calendar that God created and all the other calendars that are from the ancient Middle East. One of the things that's fascinating about these calendars is that the month, each day of the month, is always determined by observation. You and I go by a well-defined calendar. We know when leap year is going to be. All this stuff is worked out perfectly. And our calendar is a hybrid of months of uneven numbers of days that ultimately end up in a 365-day solar year. Okay? The moon cycles and the sun cycles do not coincide. And that's a good thing. If they did, it would create what's called orbital harmonics, and as an astronomer, we would be in deep trouble. Orbital harmonics are bad, bad things. They're like feedback to a sound system. They amplify the effects of gravity and distort things and make your solar system unstable. The fact that the moon's path around the Earth and the sun, Earth's path around the sun do not ever quite coincide is a good thing, but it makes it very complicated to run a calendar. One of the great hoaxes of the 21st century has been going on now for 2 years, and that is that the Mayan calendar somehow predicts the end of the world on December 21st at the winter solstice 2 years from now, which is nonsense because real, living, nearly full-blooded Mayan descendants are saying that, no, that's not what it means. It means that the new calendar starts December 22nd. Just like anybody else's calendar, you get to the end of the year, you start a new cycle. That's all it means to them. A cycle ends that day. Of course, there's people making millions of dollars off of a movie that's just a piece of junk. But there's something else weird going on. With a lunar-based calendar, every calendar starts when the high priest or the priests in Jerusalem see the crescent moon for the first time after having not seen it for several, having not seen the moon for a few days, okay, at sunset. They actually had an observer, now not today, but in the past, they actually had an observer whose job was to watch for the crescent moon. If he saw it, trumpets were blown, that moment, the new month starts. That's fine if everybody has immediate contact with Jerusalem. But if you are in Babylon, and you are hundreds of miles away, and a couple of what we would recognize as time zones away, you might not be able to guess that the new month has started. So Jews in different parts of the world after the diasporas, the two main diasporas that they've had, realized that the possibility exists of people observing the first day of the month on a different day. Now, the first day of the month is always a Sabbath, no matter what day of the week it occurs on. There are certain things that must be done. They must blow a ram's horn every time, and certain things have to happen. But some other things, major holidays, like the one called Rosh Hashanah, also occurs on the first day of a month, which means that there's a lot of uncertainty as to when it started. So Rosh Hashanah is one of the feasts that is usually today observed on 2 days, not one, just in case you get it wrong, you get two chances at it. Okay? That's the way this stuff really works. Now, that's not the way the Bible intended it to work. That's the way it works now because of the diaspora. Another thing that's unique is that Passover, being the 14th, and Feast of Sukkot, which is the 15th, well, the full moon is always going to happen either on the 14th or the 15th, okay? Which means that out of 12 months in a year, two of the major holidays are always going to happen on full moons. Well, guess what? You can never have a lunar eclipse on any day but a full moon, which means that 2 months out of 12 every year, there's a 1 in 6 chance of a blood red moon happening on Passover or at the Feast of Booths. Well, it just so happens that in the year 2014 and the year 2015, both years, Passover and Booths have full lunar eclipses, blood moons, four in a row on two Jewish holidays. And yes, people are whacked out at all the significance of that event, even though this is about the 30th time it's happened in the last 2,000 years. One other thing that's fascinating is that because the month always starts with a new moon, all solar eclipses can only happen basically on the last day of a month or right at the beginning of a month. It cannot happen. You cannot have a solar eclipse on any day of the month except the last day of the first day. So isn't this really different? That's because it's all stuck to the moon. Well, we have the Bible talking about signs in the sun goes black. Does that sound like a solar eclipse? Sometimes it really does. But what happened at the moment of Jesus' death? On the afternoon of the 14th, when the sun went dark, right? That can't be a solar eclipse because the night before was a lunar eclipse. You can't have those back to back. They must be 14 days apart, always, no exception. So this kind of dovetails, this is at the backbone of what's happening. Remember saying a long time ago that, maybe I didn't say it here, maybe I said it to myself, at Jesus' birth, there were only two groups of people that understood the meaning of his birth. One was astronomers, who were in the line of Daniel in terms of their schooling, and the other were two really old prophets that kind of got it straight, okay, Simeon and Zechariah. Oh, and Anna. Now, what is at stake here is that when Jesus died, by all calculations, his death, his resurrection, and Pentecost all lined up to the day with events that were on the Hebrew calendar. In fact, there are basically 7 major events on the original Hebrew calendar. Today there's about 12, 13. And Jesus fulfilled the first 4 by these events happening on those days. That's the theory. But the second half of the calendar, Jesus is not mentioned as ever doing anything on those days. So the theory is that those 3 events are prophetic events, that the Hebrew calendar is a prophetic calendar. This is from a guy named Roy Reinhold. The annual feast days are the prophetic plan of God. So this is my idea. Learn what I can about the feasts in the Hebrew calendar. Learn what I can about the relationship of Jesus' death and resurrection and Pentecost to that calendar. See if there are things I can learn about the relationship between the calendar and the fulfillment of prophecy, and then begin to apply those to the second half of the calendar. That's what we're about to do. Now, there is one more issue, and that is that sometimes it is really difficult to understand the Hebrew feast and calendar because the Jews themselves don't agree on anything. What's happened is every time they lost the temple, they made new changes and new rules. And the last 2,000 years, with the diaspora being over all 24 time zones, they have continued to change things. And the Jews of Europe, the Ashkenazi, those guys observe the feast one way. The Jews of North Africa, the Sephardic Spanish Jews of South America, they do it one way. The Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem do it one way. In New York, the Orthodox Jews there do it differently. The Reform do it differently. The Conservative do it differently. And the Kabbalah is all different. So every time you turn around, you know, looks like there's a good dozen different organized groups that have different regulations about these feasts. So it's a little difficult to wade through all that. The feasts that I think right now are really curious are the ones the Bible doesn't address. The Feast of Purim, which is associated with Esther. Festival of Lights, or the dedication of the temple, which Jesus did observe in John chapter 4. But that relates to Christmas somehow as far as time on the calendar. Nobody knows what to make of that. And they've got days of fasting for the Holocaust. That's not in the Bible. They've got days of fasting for different Jewish scholars that died as martyrs different times in the ancient days. So their calendar is quite full of stuff. And they have embellished the feasts. Try to imagine what Christmas was 500 years ago. You remember the whole idea, at the best, basically kids got some fruits or something. The Jews have done to Passover something that sounds like what the pagans have done to Christmas. When you hear it, it'll blow your mind. So you got the idea that their month is a little unstable, that these numbers are fuzzy because it's based on observation, not a calendar. Things shift each year. The reason that Easter shifts every year is because Passover does change every year. About every 4 years or so, they actually add an extra month. Instead of a leap day, they have a leap month. About once every 4 years, they have 13 months. The Jewish calendar is agricultural. And much of what the Fall Moshe Almanac is based on comes from the Old Testament, comes from this calendar. It is the oldest, clearest, most detailed agricultural planning, harvesting calendar there is. And every culture had to have it. Many of those calendars were astronomical. The Egyptians' calendar was astronomical. They had to know when the floods were coming. And they figured out that the floods were coming every time Orion rises at a certain point, at a certain time in the night sky. And then all the mythologies of Osiris and Isis and all that kind of stuff grew up from their astronomical observations because when Orion rises, the floods are coming. They had this mixed in. What I think is profoundly unique about the Hebrew calendar is that God has taken the events of the Exodus and made them into an agricultural calendar. Try to keep that in mind, because the Exodus is two things. It is the salvation of the children of Israel. It is the creation of the kingdom of Israel. Those two things, that's what the Exodus describes. It is their salvation, and it is their kingdom. Those are two things that's created. Everybody knows Passover. That's the day when Moses told the Israelites, you go out on the 10th of the month, you pick a spotless lamb. On the afternoon before the 14th starts at sunset, you go, you slaughter that lamb. You take its blood and you put the blood on the post and lintel of your little adobe out there. And you go in and you eat this thing and you eat unleavened bread. You don't have any leaven in the house. And you eat it and you eat it quickly. It's your last meal before you hit the road. And you don't leave any scraps. Everything must be either eaten or burned. Don't leave anything else. And you do this, you obey me in this, and you will live. Otherwise, the firstborn is going to die. Every firstborn is going to die. And of course, when the Pharaoh realized that his own son was dead, in the middle of the night, he chases down Moses and says, get them out of here. And the Exodus begins before sunrise. The Passover, that day, is about the salvation of the firstborn. Now, Jesus ate a Passover meal. How in the world did he eat a Passover meal if he's the Passover lamb? Everybody look at 1 Corinthians 5, verses 6 through 8. This is where Paul has just got done telling the Corinthians, who we'll be studying later, to get rid of, or at least excommunicate, this guy for immorality. Purge yourselves. Don't boast about this. Pay attention to what you're doing. This is unhealthy stuff. Put a stop to it. He says, your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Does everybody here understand leaven? It is what makes bread inflate and taste yummy, that little butter. It makes it expand and become really useful with all kinds of food arrangements. Look at verse 7. Clean out the old leaven so that you yourself might be a new piece of dough, wheat, bread product, okay, without the leaven. Because you are, in fact, unleavened, because you're believers in Christ. Your teaching, your thinking has been cleansed of leaven. And as Jesus said, the leaven of the Pharisees, and the Corinthians, it will be the leaven of paganism, false teachings of all kinds, leaven. For Christ our Passover has also been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Got the idea? Leaven in this scenario is always bad in this context. It represents bad teaching, false teaching, heresies, lies, deceptions, wickedness, malice, evil. Basically, everything contrary. Now, here's something about this calendar that you need to know. I'm going to try to draw it here. The day in which they eat the lamb sacrificed for the firstborn is sunset after the calendar has turned to the 14th. This day right here, the 15th, and all the days following that for 7 days, this is called the day of Passover or the Lord's Passover. This is the Feast of Unleavened Bread starting here on the 15th. Remember when the Pharisees refused to go into Pilate's chambers? And they said, we can't go in lest we be unclean and unable to eat the feast. That was after Jesus had already had the Passover. The meal that Jesus had is not the feast they're talking about. This is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This is also called Feast of the Passover. What Paul says right here, Christ our Passover, he's not talking about the firstborn. He's saying Christ is the lamb of this feast. He is the lamb of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that is exactly correct. Now, here's how that works. Their days do not start at midnight like the Romans' days do. And we have Roman days here in America now. Their day starts at sunset. That's how they count days. So, if this is the 13th, right about here on the evening or the afternoon of the 13th is when the Paschal Lamb for the Lord's Passover for the firstborn, that's when it is killed. Jesus sent John and Peter to go do that about the time that he gave his message on Mount Olives. Here, in the evening, it's now turned the 14th, Jesus is eating the Passover Lamb of the Lord's Passover. Here, about the middle of the night, right at sunrise, this is when the Pharisees said, we don't want to go in there lest we be unable to eat the feast. Right here, on the 15th, the beginning of the 15th, this is when the feast begins. This is 3 p.m. on the afternoon of the 14th. That's when the lamb is killed for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's when Jesus died. We're calling him the Passover Lamb, but it's not about the Exodus event of saving the firstborn. Jesus did not die for the firstborn, just the firstborn. He is the firstborn. He died to become the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, Jesus called himself manna from heaven. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. John calls Jesus the Word. Everything about the Feast of Unleavened Bread is that Jesus becomes our food. What I didn't show you up here is that here he is. He dies on the afternoon of the 14th. One full day, which is a Sabbath, and then another day, and then another day. The next day, Sunday morning, is the Feast of First Fruits. And it's not truly a feast, it's just the presentation of the first few grains from the field. It is representative that your barley harvest has started, at least your barley are growing. It's not a harvest, it's not anywhere near harvest, but you've got some grain starting. These are unripe grains, but these are the first heads of grain. They're brought to the temple and they're presented at sunrise with trumpets as a wave offering about the same time Jesus' tomb was discovered empty. That is no accident. He had 360 days that year. He could have done that. He did it on that day. He could have died 360 days of the year, but he died on that day. And there's no way to deny that this was prearranged. To me, that is really awesome. Now, Pentecost happens. Pentecost is really curious. That's a Greek word. It's not really important. What is important is that Pentecost is the day when you celebrate the barley harvest. And Israel is known for its famous barley harvest. Very common, very useful food substance. This is how you get there. From the day that you have the first fruit, from the day of Jesus' resurrection, from the day when you take the first seeds of the barley, you count 7 weeks, 7 times 7, and the next day will also be a Sunday, the 50th day, the first day of the week. That is the day of Pentecost. That is the day you celebrate the harvest. And what happened on Pentecost? We had a harvest. We had a real barley harvest. Now, that could have happened on any other number of days, but it happened on that day. Now, part of what I want you to see is that there are 4 major calendar events there. Christ partook of one and fulfilled the others. Now, I wonder if that relates to what's coming. That's the big question. And I told you there's something funny that the Jews have done about Passover. Listen to this. They have taken leaven, and instead of realizing that Jesus is talking about spiritual things, not literal things, remember how many times he said that? They've decided to make a game out of it. And so sometime on the 13th in the afternoon or whatever, when they go out and they look for the leaven, oh, there's no leaven in that house. Hasn't been leaven in the house for 20 years. But they're going to go around and they're going to make sure that there's no leaven. They clean it out real carefully, but then the children have to go look. And there has to be a moment at which there's some kind of prayer for the cleansing of the leaven. And a long time ago, they felt like, well, it's going to look stupid for us to pray for the cleansing of the leaven if there wasn't any. So they deliberately go and they take 10 little balls of dough with leaven in them. And they have to be smaller than olives so that they don't violate the law. And they put them through the house. And the daddy and the children go running through the house to find the little leaven balls. And they celebrate when they find one. And then they have their little ritual to get rid of it. Of course, mommy knows where they all are in case they miss one. And so that's the way they do it now. But they really make a big deal about the leaven. They have no Easter egg hunt. Exactly. Where do you think this comes from? You can see that even though the unleavened bread was based on them running from Egypt and not being able to have the leaven of Egypt with them on the road, he took the Exodus events, he took their salvation from Egypt and made it symbolic of the harvest. The planting of the seed, Christ was planted and resurrected. You plant the seed, 3 days later it sprouts, okay? They took the agricultural calendar and the salvation experience of Israel in Egypt and merged them. And then they layered it by taking it and putting the real Christ, the real Jesus, the real salvation, the real immortality, everything, and layered it again. You've got 3 layers now. You have the salvation of Israel in Egypt. You have agricultural provision. You have salvation because now you have food. And every year your God brings you a harvest. And now you have eternal life. And they all 3 occur on the same date, the same calendar. Okay, you got the picture? To summarize the first half of the Jewish calendar, Jesus is our food. Think of all the times when he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. He doesn't mean flesh and blood. He means his ideas, his words, his thoughts, his knowledge, his character, everything about his soul. It is his soul. It is his spirit that keeps us alive. We live by Christ in us. We live by literally taking into ourselves every word that proceeds the mouth of God. In this case, Jesus is the Word. And that is what all of this really, really shows. Now, let's switch to the half a year. We're now in the fall. And we're now at the wheat harvest is approaching. But there are some extraordinary things happening here. The calendar, the Jewish calendar, has two New Years in it, 6 months apart. The month that includes Passover is the ceremonial New Year. That is like the spiritual New Year. But in the fall, the beginning of the year, is the civil, legal New Year. Now, our New Year starts after the winter solstice in January, which I think is a Roman invention again. But the Babylonians and all the Semitic cultures shared this fall New Year. The New Year starts with the harvest. Isn't that great? You start by sucking in all your wealth and all your harvest, and you start with a bounty. Yeah. So the first day of the seventh month, and there's your seven again, the seventh month of the religious calendar is the civil New Year, the legal New Year. It is the time of the harvest. It's called Rosh Hashanah. Rosh means head. Hashanah, the year. Head of the year. Start of the year. That's literally what it means. Now, some of these poor folks that are trying to make that look like the rapture because of the concept of horns. We're going to deal with that first. Preparation for the holiest day of the Jewish year, which is not Rosh Hashanah, but Yom Kippur 10 days later, actually starts a whole month earlier. They take about 40 days to pray and confess sins and make relationships right and make business deals right and do all this kind of stuff before Yom Kippur on the 10th day of that month, 10 days after trumpets. They blow trumpets. They blow the ram's horn, the shofar, every day for a month and a half. And on the 10th day, Yom Kippur, they're supposed to blow that horn all over the whole country at a certain point in the day's events. Those are all shofars. Guess what? There is no shofar in the book of Revelation. The trumpets in Revelation are not shofars. It's not the word for shofar. It's not a ram's horn. It's the word used of the silver trumpets that were made for Solomon. Why would that be the case? What do you have to do to have a ram's horn? Just exactly how many dead rams are there in heaven? There's not going to be one. They've got the wrong horn. The wrong trumpet. That little dichotomy is consistent and I think has to be one of the limits of how we interpret this. I don't think you can take these feasts, these festivals, and look at them and relate them to the biblical trumpets in Revelation. They're not the same thing. Is it possible that they may relate in meaning? Even that's questionable. So, you have this day which is little more than a celebration for a new year. It is a Sabbath, no matter what day of the week it occurs on, for two reasons. One, it's a new moon, and every new moon is a Sabbath. And the other is that it's the end of the year, it's a celebration because of what's about to happen. The new year brings forth the opportunity for Yom Kippur and for the harvest. Yom Kippur has grown wildly in the Jewish mind, and they've created a bunch of mythologies. And one of their fundamental mythologies is that everybody's actions are being written down in a book. This is the book of life. You've heard the book of life mentioned in the Bible many times. The idea here is that you're going to be judged, and you had better spend that time searching your soul, getting right with God, making things right with individuals so that at the end of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and your name is not removed from the book of life. The righteous are automatically put in, the questionable are held off, and then the others are written off. And of course, Yom Kippur ends with the assumption that your atonement was successful so that everybody's atoned for. It's kind of a liberal way of looking at it, but that's the way they do it. They call call that the 10 days of awe, the first 10 days of that month when they are searching their souls and preparing for this day. I want you to remember some of the events now that happened. Yom Kippur, this is the day the priest, this is the one day of the year when the priest can go in. He actually has to go in more than once. He goes into the holiest of holies. He goes into the place where the ark is. He goes in. The first thing he does is go in there with a bowl of hot coals and with the frankincense or cinnamon spices, and he puts them on there to create a cloud. He has to fill the room with the smoke to start with. That's the first thing he does. That's interesting. Then he goes back and he gets the blood of a bull to take care of himself. He atones for himself and his family. And then he goes in with the blood of a ram to atone for the nation. So that's three trips. Each time he goes in with a rope around his ankle, in case he screws up and dies on the spot, he can be drug out. Bells on his robes, and he's supposed to keep moving. If people stop hearing the bells for too long, they know he's staying still for too long, they might pull the rope. That's not the main event of Yom Kippur. The main event happens after the whole nation has had all this atonement done. They bring in two goats, and they put the goats out there, and the whole nation can look down on the Temple Mount. You can see the Temple Mount Plaza from the mountains around. The Mount of Olives is probably covered with thousands of people, and other parts of the hill, possibly even on Zion, and the rooftops, all the place, people everywhere by the thousands are watching. And they take these two goats, and they draw lots. You know, they take two sticks, and one's longer than the other, and they hide them, and they draw a lot, and one of those decides which goat lives and which goat dies. And they kill one of the goats, and they offer up a sacrifice. Then he goes to the other goat, and it's held tight, and he puts his hands on its head. And he confesses again for the last time the sins of the nation, and all their sins are placed on that goat. And then that goat is carried out of the temple, carried out of the city, carried over the Mount of Olives, is carried down toward the Dead Sea, and he's let go near the Dead Sea. No one knows exactly where, but the region's called the region of the scapegoat. This is a big mystery. 10 years ago when I discovered the answer to this, I was so blown away. The word for scapegoat is Atzilah. There is a place in that region called Ha-Atzilah, and I believe it is the region that Zechariah 14 calls Atzel. Now, this is going to be key to our attempt to understand the feasts of the fall, is the scapegoat. Now, the harvest is about to really take place here. There's two more things that happen at Yom Kippur. They blow the trumpet again. This time it is a ram's horn. Now, every 7 years at this point, when the ram's horn is blown, it becomes the year of the freeing of the slaves. The enslavement of Hebrews by Hebrews is legal, but it is a very carefully defined enslavement, and it is nothing like any slavery that you would recognize among the pagans. This is like an indentured servant. You are selling your services and your rights for a period of time, basically to get out of debt or to pay off a debt or something, but it lasts no more than 6 years. The seventh year, you're a free man no matter what. And every 7 years, this place cleaned. We're back to the seven-year cycle. Every seven sets of 7 years, on the following year, it's called the year of Jubilee. Jubal means ram's horn. Just like shofar means ram's horn, except Jubilee or Jubal is the older word for it. On the 50th year, when the ram's horn is blown, at the end of Yom Kippur, not only are all the slaves freed, but every piece of land that has changed ownership is returned to its original owner. There is no such thing in ancient Israel as fee simple ownership of the land. Everything is leased, and the maximum lease is 49 years. So every family gets its property back. That's the Jubilee. You get it back. But the symbol is the ram's horn. That is clear. And it happens after the scapegoat is released, once every 50 years. Then they come back and they have this one more feast 5 days later, while all the Israelites are still there, And this is a celebration of the great harvest of the year. It is a huge feast. It is 7 days long. They have to slaughter nearly 200 bulls ceremonially, not counting all the other thousands of sacrifices that take place. They're right around 200 sacrificial bulls done this time. And they're all prescribed in great detail in the Bible and the law of the Feast of Booths. Now, Feast of Booths, Sukkot, S-U-C-C-O-T-H, and Tabernacles are all three the same thing. Those are all three different sets of words. It means that for a 7 day period of time, you will live in huts like you did during the Exodus. Now, remember I said this is still agriculture and still Exodus? Right? The first half of the Exodus is the salvation in the beginning, but now you are being saved as you endure in the wilderness. You are in a temporary dwelling place, a hut, which is a lean-to with any kind of plant covering you can make. It's a leafy plant, basically. Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Sukkot. But it is a feast, a big feast. It's the biggest feast of the year. Now, it is the biggest harvest of the year. But there's one more thing. You and I are described as being temples of God, being built into a greater temple. We are tabernacles. Our flesh and blood is a tent that your soul resides in. Your body is a temporary booth. It is a sukkot. It is a hut. It is a tabernacle. Your spirit is waiting for its new home, which is described, depending on your translation, as a palace or a mansion. But compared to the flesh and blood body you have now, the glorified Christ-like body that you receive is a palace beyond your imagination. Paul says no man has ever been able to really imagine what God has planned for those he honors. So I think the Feast of Booths would likely have something to do with our looking back to remember that there was a time when we lived in huts, a time when we lived as flesh and blood because we're no longer flesh and blood. Okay, that's one idea. That is related to the harvest, which, of course, we know there's early rains and latter rains. The early rains happen just before Pentecost. The latter rains happen just before Yom Kippur. All this stuff goes together. The Feast of Booths. It is the remission of debts every 7 years. All debts are released at the Feast of Booths. Here's something about the Feast of Booths. You go out to the hills and bring in olive branches, wild olive tree branches, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of other leafy trees to make booths. Now, this is in Nehemiah. This is when they came back and celebrated. The entire assembly of those who had returned from captivity made booths and lived in them. Indeed, the sons of Israel had not done this since the days of Joshua. In other words, in the days of Nehemiah was the first time since Joshua died that the nation had actually observed the festival correctly. They went 1,000 years without doing this right. No wonder they modified it and made it up. They didn't trust God to provide for them the extra food, the extra 2 years worth of food necessary if this thing is a jubilee. Remember in Luke 21, Jesus gives a prophecy. Matthew and Mark omit the sentence. This is what it says in Matthew and Mark. When you see the fig tree sprout, know that all these things are near. Luke says, when you see the fig tree and all the trees sprout, you will know that summer is near. This booth situation, the Feast of Booths, to make your booth, you are to go and take every kind of leafy branch to make a booth. Now wait till you hear about the possibility of that being connected to Luke. This is all of Zechariah 14. It starts off with what I believe this was fulfilled in 1948. Jerusalem has been captured and destroyed about 29 times historically. It was only split in two and occupied by opposing forces once. That was 1948 to 1967. Here it is, Zechariah 14. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. May 15, 1948, when they began to get the land back. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women raped, and half the city exiled. That is exactly what happened in 1948. Half the city evacuated, but the rest of the people were not cut off. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights the day of battle. I think this day when the spoil is taken from you as the divide back hasn't really fully come yet. It's only started, kind of like the first fruits. But the big harvest, when this really happens, is waiting for the Day of Atonement when all the land returns to its original owners. There's another catch here. One of the big issues in the Year of Jubilees is when it starts. And they finally decided that it couldn't have started until all of the Canaanites are gone from the land, because they would have had a right to having the land returned back to them after 50 years. So they never counted the 50 years until the last Canaanite was gone. But that never happened. So all the Jubilees since then have been done with this haunting feeling in the back that, but we never really owned all the land. And when we give it back, we're giving back some of it to the enemies. Think about this. There's always been Canaanites, and the right way to do Sukkot is to go out and get all the leafy plants. Jesus said, you know summer's near, but all the nations around Israel are blooming, all the trees, not just Israel. What's happened since World War I? Nearly every nation in the Middle East has been born since World War I. The Ottoman Empire overran them and dominated for 400 years. These nations are brand new since World War I. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, Somalia, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, India. I think pretty much all those nations are brand new. Less than 100 years old. Okay? Perhaps Libya and Algeria too. At any rate, when the Ottoman Empire fell, all these nations became independent nations again. And I think there's a chance that that relates to what Jesus said when he said, when you see all the trees. Now, it gets worse. This sounds like the rapture to everybody. It is not. Guys, we're close to making an awesome point. At the end of the sixth trumpet, the scapegoat is the highlight of Yom Kippur. Now, I said sixth trumpet. Zechariah 14. In that day, the day when Jesus is beginning to make arrangements to give them all the land back, in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from the east to the west by a very large valley. Half of the mountain will move north and half will move south. You will flee through that valley by the valley of my mountains, for the valley will reach all the way to Adzel. You will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord, my God, will come with his powerful angels. The sixth trumpet before the Antichrist gets to Jerusalem ends with this devastating earthquake in Jerusalem. It's the only one described. It's the only one in the prophecies except this one. Why are the Jews going to leave Jerusalem if Jesus is coming for them? They're leaving Jerusalem because he isn't here yet. They're leaving because the Antichrist is going to take advantage of the destruction to get the city. But guess where they go? The Jews become a scapegoat. Now, if that earthquake happens on Yom Kippur, it will make perfect sense to me. Because that's the day Israel becomes the scapegoat. That is the day when the remnant of Jerusalem is created. That's the group that we find out later that the Antichrist wants to destroy, but they are given the wings of the great eagle and taken off into the wilderness to a place where they're kept safe for 3.5 years. I think that all that goes together. They become the scapegoat, the ones who carry the sins of the nation with them into the wilderness. They are the ones that will find Christ. They were the ones that will finally come to him, the ones that carried the sins of the nation. At that time, there will be a day in which there will be no light, and all the lights of the sky will fade. It will be a unique day, not only to the Lord. Neither day nor night, it will come about that at evening there will be light. Jesus said, no man knows the day or the hour. This is the day that no one knows about. This is what Jesus is talking about. Right here, the day when there is no light, the unique day known alone to the Lord, neither day nor night. Most of us don't think of the rapture as being a day in which the sun goes dark, a day in which is not day nor night, a day of the Lord. But to me, it must be the same day. And in that day, at that time, in that time frame following that event, in that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half toward the western sea, Dead Sea, Mediterranean. It will be the same way all year round. The Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be the only Lord, his name, the only one that is worshipped. All the land will be changed from a plain, raised up into a flat plateau from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. That's about 60 miles. But Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from the gate of Benjamin as far as the first gate. It describes all that stuff with wine presses. People will live there. There will no longer be a curse. Remember the curse upon the land that Isaiah described as being gone? The lion lies down with the lamb. The weeds are gone. The thorns are gone. The ground is no longer inhospitable. All that's gone, at least in Israel. Now, this is where it gets wild. We're talking about the enemies of Israel at this time. Now, this will be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot where they stand. This is one of only two places in the whole Bible that I think has anything, any resemblance to an explosion or force or power that resembles a nuclear bomb. I don't necessarily think it is, but the level of force is the same. They will rot where they stand. Their eyes will rot in the sockets. Their tongue will rot in their mouth right where they stand. It will come about in that day that a great panic from the Lord will fall upon all the nations which have gone to war against Jerusalem, so that they will seize one another's hand and kill each other. Remember, that's how Jehoshaphat's battle was won. Three nations slaughtered each other in the confusion. This, to me, is Armageddon. There's bloodshed. There's tremendous bloodshed because all these Arab nations, all the nations come against Israel, slaughter themselves in great confusion. That, to me, is what Armageddon is like. The great harvest. Judah will also fight, starting at Jerusalem, and the wealth of the surrounding nations will be gathered, the gold and silver and all that kind of stuff. But the plague will also be on everything, all the animals, the horse, the mule, the camel, the donkey, and all the cattle that they stored with them, everything that they have, will suffer this way. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against the Lord, now this is it. Remember the leafy trees for the booth and all the leaves? You know summer's near? Get this. It will come about in those days, after all this happens, then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations who went against Jerusalem at that time will go up each year to worship the Lord, the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booth. It will be that whichever of the families of earth does not go up to worship the King to Jerusalem, there will have no rain. If the family of Egypt does not come up to the Feast of Booth, there will have no rain. That will be a plague upon any nation that does not celebrate the Feast of Booth. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that fail to celebrate the Feast of Booth. All the enemies of Israel now serve them at the Feast of Booth. They come and live in huts, while Israel lives in palaces. In that day, they will be described on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar. Every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord of hosts. All who sacrifice and come and take will boil them, and there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord. Doesn't all this stuff tie together? If there's a way of pegging any of this to the calendar, the only one that strikes me is the connection between Yom Kippur and the scapegoat. But in Jesus' case, he did all of them in sequence. All of them in the same year. All of them with literal days. What's this about? If that happened, the time frame's compressed. I don't know how to see it that way. I don't know how to see these three events as happening in the course of a literal 21 days, which is the way Jesus did the first ones. Now, all the other people who are dealing with this are trying to make it symbolic when they're very inconsistent. I know of no one who's made the connection to the scapegoat yet, but they should. It is worth learning the feasts. All this is based on Leviticus 23. Remember that you'll have to get past what the Jews have done to it today, and you'll have to get past what the Christians have done with their feasts and stuff. But I do think that, at the very least, our Feast of Tabernacles, it's when we, with glorified immortal bodies, look back on what it was like to have been flesh and blood. And we are grateful that that period of time is coming, God. Isn't that cool? Let's pray together. Father, we love you and we trust you. We ask, please, that in all these things and in all that's the news around the world and the events to come in our lives, that you would help these ideas from the Scripture to help us understand more clearly what it is you're doing and what extraordinary thing you have done with human history to write upon it the salvation of your people, the harvest, and the kingdom of heaven, whose reign starts here and never ends. In Jesus' name.